Hi everyone, I'm Jenna Millie with Screenwriting U, and I'm here today with Abby Morgan, who wrote Suffragette, which stars Carey Mulligan and Meryl Streep. Hi, Abby.
Hi. Nice to talk to you.
Yes, so nice to talk to you too. I just love the film. It's so moving and poignant, and
oh, that's right.
I cried a lot. I don't know if you had a cry meter, but I cry. I probably hit the top of the charts on the crying.
It was so moving.
You know, it was so, the theater clapped after it was over too. It was such a great film. I have so many questions for you. What I read that Maud, the main character, the Carey Mulligan character, is a composite of several women. How did you put that together, that storyline?
Well, I mean, Sarah Gavron, the director, it had been a passion project for her for over a decade, really. And she came to me about 6 years ago and with an incredible body of research that she had gathered with Alison Owen, the producer, also on this. And really, I think it was reading just the simple testimonials of the working women and, you know, incredible, you know, the police records at the time and some of the extent of the surveillance operation on the women and the sort of the news articles and just the kind of tiny little bits of, you know, that these 19th century women's voices that I heard was just so fascinating to me and felt so oddly contemporary that I think I moved very quickly away from the notion of doing a pure biopic in the traditional sense of focusing on Mrs. Pankhurst's life or Andy Wilding Davison to really hone in on the working class woman. And so she comes from several places, really. I mean, I think what we wanted to do was, you know, all the issues that the women, working woman, were dealing with at that time, which were, you know, appalling work conditions, sexual abuse at work and at home, custodial rights over their children, equal pay, just felt very 21st century. And particularly in a sort of digital age in a world of social media where we're kind of, I think one is increasingly aware of the global inequalities all over the world and there's a sort of growing sense of activism, but the working woman again felt like the right place to start to build the character of Maud. So she really came from several different characters, but sort of honing in particularly on some of the women's testimonials I read around the kind of laundresses and domestic servants of that time.
Well, the setting is just wonderful, you know, just from a writer's standpoint, because you have, you know, this place that we really, the audience doesn't know what it's like to work in the glass house laundry. We just call it a laundry factory, a laundress.
A laundry. And it actually, what's very funny is I used to have an office very near a laundry. And I used to watch all these workers, you know, picking up bags of napkins. And I'd see, you know, you'd see millions and millions of men and women in this sort of factory when it was very hot, they'd open the gate. And it made me think that it was, you know, there are those sweatshops all over the UK and certainly globally. So, again, I think it was, that world was very rich, you know. I think when Sarah and I first started to look at the photos, the glass house laundry, particularly, and that's the laundry it's modelled on, the thing that really, you know, at first was quite deceptive because you saw these images of these women in white, you know, white shirts, starched white shirts and black aprons, and they looked very, it looked very sort of calm and very ordered and very neat. And then when I started to read about the symptoms and the injuries and the kind of appalling effects that the working conditions had in some of these laundries, it felt like there was a contradiction. I was reminded that these photographs were staged. And actually behind the image of the kind of starched collar and the apron was this appalling life, you know, and where women were, you know, getting paid often a third of what men were getting paid and were having to juggle children at home and, you know, and were dealing with, you know, sexual aggression from their bosses as well as their husbands, you know. And so it felt like a very rich place to start to focus in on.
And how did you come up with Maud's backstory? Because what I loved about the film is how it sort of trickles out. You know, at first she says that the factory boss is a nice man, or the foreman, he's nice. But then you realize the abuse that he's been giving her. And also, there's many things I took away. You know, I don't know if you want to reveal to the audience her entire backstory, but I started to think, That maybe he was her father. Maybe he had fathered the child that she had with her husband.
That's really interesting. I mean, Maud has gone through such a massive journey in terms of finding that character. Originally, she was actually a character who came into the house of Alice, who is the Romola Garai character. And that was my first draft, was very much focused on that, on Alice's house and this laundress or sort of domestic servant who's very good at laundry coming into the house and the relationship between her. And then very quickly when I started to read about the laundry, I thought, well, I want to start to look at the workplace of the laundry. And so maybe Alice has a relationship as a sort of charitable concern that she goes to the laundry. And out of that came the character of Maud. But I think for both Sarah and I, what was interesting was to look at how does someone move towards militant activism and how, you know, the breadth of that journey from going from a place where you seem to be very ambivalent towards a movement, and then you start to identify and connect and realize that it starts to have this cathartic and revelatory kind of effect on your own life. And I think, you know, when she goes that first day, when she goes to deliver a package to Oxford Street, and she witnesses the night of the broken panes, which was an actual historical event, it was about imagining what would it have been like if you were just walking down that street that day, and would it have ignited your own sense of latent activism, or would it have made you suddenly see the voiceless gain voice, and would you have then connected with perhaps your own injustices? So Maud really is a sort of composite of somebody who goes from that place of not wanting to be part of something, not wanting to be awoken, to absolutely waking up to the kind of huge amount of suppression and injustices that she's lived with her entire life. And so particularly that relationship with Taylor is very profound for me, because I think he has been her father in a way. He's been paternal. He's been the man who gave her attention and affection, and eventually he's the man who allows her probably to have a relationship with Sonny, because he knows that he can't keep her there in that way. But all the while, you know that actually the biggest control is the kind of sexual control he's had over her, and actually it's only when she grows up and grows older and sees that being transferred onto another child in the form of Maggie, Violet's daughter, that I think she really starts to compound her own growing activism.
Yes, I agree. And it's just such a triumphant moment, too, when she, you know, takes care of Maggie.
I mean, one of the questions that have said is why didn't she tell Violet before? Why she never told Violet? I don't know if you felt that when you watched it. Why is she not telling anybody? But it was so complex. It's so complex when if you've been abused and then you see someone else be abused, it's very complex, because you have to confront that abuse in yourself. And if it's something that you've never given words to, it's a journey for her to find her voice. And she couldn't free herself when she was a child, but she can free this next generation. And that was the sort of idea of it.
Yeah, that was great. And I think she couldn't tell her, because there's really nothing you can do about it. You know, they said that she was the only one making money for that family. So what are they going to do? Just have her pull her out?
But. And in a way, that comes out. You know, some of the things that were said by these women were just very lightly delivered. You know, there was a sort of, I mean, you know, I recently got sent a great quote actually from my producer, and you know, I think we all slightly enjoy still finding the great kind of suffragette quotes, and I just thought it was so fantastic. And Mrs. Packer says, you have to make more noise than anybody else. You have to make yourself more obtrusive than anybody else. You have to fill all the papers more than anybody else. In fact, you have to be there all the time and see that they do not snow you under if you are really going to get reform realised. And, you know, when Sarah and I was working on this film, we kept on hearing these kind of profound and prophetic words that Mrs. Pankhurst was saying to these women, and they just resonated today. You know?
Yeah.
And in an age where we're still trying to get equality of pay, you know, I think it does connect. And so, you know, I think it's quite a personal journey. I think the whole producing team behind this, and certainly the actors, went on in making it, because it definitely, I think, the journey of Maud started to reflect our own kind of dormant activism that got reignited through the course of making the film, you know.
And I think as a woman watching it, you start asking yourself, would I have done this? How, you know, it really becomes very personal. And you start wondering, could, you know, especially after she spends the first night or several nights in jail, you think, could, would I have gone back the next day? But what I thought was really interesting about the writing, and this seems so hard to do, so I would love to know the secret, is how you balanced her family life, which is on one side, with her duty. So you know she wants to raise her son and be a good mother, but then she has to do her duty to the movement. And I always felt, as watching it, that she was doing the right thing. Although when I say that out loud, it seems, you know, not very caring towards the kid. But how did you balance that? That you got the audience to rally behind her when she was, you know, essentially she wasn't being. She had this choice: be a mother to her child, or support the movement.
I think on a really personal level, I think I identified with the notion of when you gain knowledge, you can no longer deny it. And there's a very key scene that looks like nothing on the page, and there's a very sort of very small but very integral scene to me in the film, which is when she's lying on the bed and she says, "What would we, if we'd had a girl, what would we have called her?" And he says, "Margaret, after my mother." And she says, "And what kind of life would she have had?" And he says, "Like yours, Maud." And for me, that's integral, is that she does this incredible sacrifice because there is nothing other that she can do, because she cannot go on living in this unbearable state herself. And that, I think, she truly believes when she first leaves or is thrown out by Sonny, I think she truly believes that if she can get the woman the vote, then she can somehow get her son back. And then when this is denied to her, because, you know, the idea that we based it on his birthday, his seventh birthday, is that up until a child was seven, a mother had some parental rights over her child. As soon as he was seven, all parental rights reverted to the father.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
And so that in itself, that's very profound. And I think in that moment, she realizes that actually she's lost this boy. And so when she says to him, "You know, your mother's name is Maud Watts, don't forget it, because I'll wait for you to find me," is that I think she recognizes that she has to, she's absolutely powerless in this situation. And so her connection and her reinvigoration with the cause is part of her drive to almost get to the point where he will come back and find her, and she will be ready and be strong enough and be politically strong enough to be able to stand by him and be his mother again. So it's a very, you know, it resonated with me, you know, in a number of ways, because you know how many women are in abusive relationships or are economically bound to a situation, and they have to make choices. And for me, it's about the pain of making that choice and the injustice of certainly women at that time. You know, and it has resonance for me in the 21st century when, you know, we look at those situations not only within, you know, the West, but across the globe. You know, we know that there are women in the Middle East and in parts of Asia and in Eastern Europe, we know that there are women who have huge, you know, inequalities that they're dealing with. And we know in this very city in LA, we know that we have huge inequalities when it comes to the industry itself. So the resonance, making that decision and it becoming a life-changing decision, and yet the only way you can keep going is forward, feels quite universal, really.
Well, it was really beautifully written. How many drafts did you do to get to that? Or is it something
I'm slightly embarrassed about the number of drafts. I mean, I don't count anymore, except I've got folders and folders of drafts. We took this apart and we put it back together, and then we took it apart again. And, you know, one of the hardest things was to give it a sense of pace and jeopardy, which I think Sarah really has achieved. But actually, you know, the major moments are the historic moments, and yet it's putting those major moments also in the minor. So it's about those profound points of change in the everyday domestic moments in Maud's life, you know, and so it was ensuring that those moments still kind of had a sense of growing escalation. And in a weird way, it is about a journey towards potential martyrdom. And it, you know, she threw herself in front of all the cameras of the world, you know, and it's beautiful, you know, it's incredibly recorded on that Pathé footage. And so it was a moment where I think this, you know, 50-year war, which had been fought peacefully for so long, suddenly really showed its most violent and sort of tragic side. And so, and yet it became the start of the point of change, with the public standing up in the media saying, "We have to pay attention to these women. This is the level of their despair is evident, and we have to start to question why we're not giving them the vote." And so that, you know, it's, it was, you know, it was kind of quite profound, really. bringing together so much of that footage. And also, I don't know if you know that, but the footage at the end of the film was actually a role that was discovered at the BFI while we were working on the film.
I didn't know that.
It's the first time it's ever been screened, that piece of footage.
Amazing.
So it really was about trying to, you know, using the present to connect with the past.
It's really incredible. I love the film, and you did an amazing job. How was this different from The Iron Lady, when you really had to stick to more of a, you had more freedom to create in this one?
With, yeah.
Could you just describe the difference for you in the writing process?
Well, I found the kind of girdle of history really helpful in this, and yet it was very liberating not to feel that I was, you know, that I was trampling on anyone's life in any one particular way. So it was very liberating in terms of, writing the character of Maud and certainly Edith and Violet and Alice, you know, our key women. But, you know, I think it was always about using the counterpoint of history and historic real characters like Emmeline Pankhurst and Emily Wilding Davis to sort of cast the light into the shadows and bring out these foot soldiers. So I found it very liberating. And to a certain degree, I think when you do any biopic, it does become a work of fiction because it has to. You aren't there and you're detecting a kind of, you're trying to find the story and you're sort of trying to kind of divine for the story as you write. And so to a certain degree, there is a process of creation anyway. So, but I didn't feel, you know, one of the things that was hard about Iron Lady was her life was so complex and huge. And actually, using the time frame of what is effectively 18 months in the movement, of a movement that's, you know, already been peacefully protesting for 50 years, it was very helpful, you know, in terms of structuring and just being able to control and interrogate the material and let go of a lot of other stuff and go, well, look, that, we're not covering that period, or we're not. And then again, also looking at it through the prism of the working class women rather than the kind of, although, we touch upon the upper middle classes and aristocratic in the form of the Pankhursts and Alices of this world and the kind of charitable ladies who give out the medals when they come out of prison. Ultimately, we are focusing on this kind of underclass, which I don't think I had seen before. And so it was good to feel, you know, it was compelling to try and connect with the real voices of those women and put them center stage, because so many of them were illiterate and they didn't write the memoirs. And then, of course, there were people like Hannah Mitchell and Annie Kenning Annie Barnes, sorry, Mary Kenny, and, you know, some very significant working class suffragettes at the time who were, you know, who went on to be, you know, very significant in the movement. But actually, it was about focusing on that, going back and focusing on the working class woman. And so to liberate yourself from the kind of rules of a biopic was really, it just took away that other challenge, you know, which is so hard with a biopic,
right,
which is that you're trying to do justice to one person's life.
Well, thank you so much, Abby. It was really amazing, and I hope everybody goes and sees this movie because it's so moving.
I hope so. I mean, that's the proof. Thumbs on the seat.
Yeah.
But thank you so much for appreciating the film. I really, honestly, I'll let Sarah know, and it's really appreciated.
Loved it. I went to see it with my neighbor, and she said, wow, I feel like I was only in there for 5 minutes. It just went so, it was so involved and so immersed.
I hope that's a good thing.
We're so immersed in the story. Like, I think you leave wanting more, which is always good.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and also everyone keeps saying, does she see her son again? Does she see her son?
I know. Does she? Can you tell me?
Well, I mean, God, who knows? But in my mind, yes, very much so. In my mind, I hope I have this idea that he will, you know, actually, he would have been, he's seven, so I'm in 1912, so another, you know, 6-8 years, and we would have been careering into the First World War. So he would be sort of 13, 14, 15. My hope that post-war he would have found her and she would have got the vote by then. So she would have got property. So in my mind, I definitely hope they would have found each other again. I'm sure, you know, I think he was very significant in her life, and I wrote the scene where she knew that he was. I wrote a scene where Steve arrives with a bag of surveillance photos, and some of them are Ooh. George on a beach in the sands, and we cut the scene in the end because it felt too limiting. But in my head, she finds him on Camber Sands. So.
Oh, good! I'm so relieved.
Fantasy scenes they wish they'd written, but you know that's probably mine. Anyway, thank you so much.
Thank you, Abby. It's such a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope I talk to you for your next film. Okay, take care.
All right. Okay, bye.
Bye.